Okay, my dad shows the worst cows. Chess is jam. With bike styles, gonna be late. My dad's gonna beat the traffic with super pie.
Your daddy's gonna be early.
My daddy's gonna lose the worst too with super car. They know the fact they know super car.
Ride Metro is the only way to beat the traffic.
The station design for Metro has a couple of origins. One is the more idealistic sense of confidence in federal government, confidence in the public realm that was expressed by the Kennedy administration in the famous Guiding Principles for Federal Architecture, drafted by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, that called on federal buildings, especially those in Washington, to provide visual testimony to the dignity, enterprise, vigor, and stability of the American government.
Welcome to Journey with Purpose, episode 30. This is your host, Randy Plummel. This is the Great Society Subway episode. We had an election last week, and it did not go the way I would prefer, and it is going to have a lot of impact on all of our lives. But instead of wallowing in that day and week in the future, and instead of storming the Capitol building, we're going to talk about how government is good. The era of big government never left the Washington Metro. Designed as one of the three mid-century heavy rail systems, which included MARTA in Atlanta and BART in the Bay Area, Metro Rail, which was built, is perhaps the most beautiful subway systems in America. And this is coming from a New Yorker. We have a few episodes about Metro Rail, WMATA, and how it has been growing and expanding. And this is the first episode, and this will give us some context of the system, what was happening that created it, and we get to speak with professor and author Zachary Schrag, who has written the excellent book, The Great Society Subway. One experiment we'll be doing on this episode is that when you hear this sound, then check your screen as we change the image so you can see what we're speaking about. This may or may not be annoying, and we might not do this in the future, but we're going to try today. Okay, on with our conversation. Professor Schrag, welcome to Journey with Purpose. Can you take us back in time when Metro was created and give us an idea of what was happening in the region and in America?
In the 1950s, a lot of Americans believed that the solution to growing urbanism was to build as many highways as possible to enable people to live in the suburbs and to drive alone downtown. And this was encoded in the Federal Highway Act of 1956 that, although it ostensibly funded an interstate highway program, a lot of that money was destined for urban freeways. This became reality in most American cities. If you go to just about any American city and try to walk from one end to another, you will be interrupted by a major freeway, and that makes the experience much less pleasant. You'll also be interrupted by a great deal of parking, whether it is big surface parking lots or structured parking garages. A lot of American cities were given up to the automobile in the 1950s and subsequent decades. Washington was different. Very early on in the 1950s, people in some of the residential neighborhoods protested. They said, we don't want these highways coming through our neighborhoods. We don't want our city carved up. And they proposed an alternative, which would be a very extensive rapid transit system. They got people in power, both in the executive branch and allies in Congress. And eventually in 1969, Congress approved a multi-billion dollar rapid transit system for the nation's capital and its suburbs. The result was something called Metro. It took more money and a lot more time than was originally proposed, but we basically have the system that was planned in the late 1960s, and I think it made a huge difference to the Washington community in terms of having fewer highways, fewer parking structures, less land devoted to that. And as a result, more people are able to get around in other ways and also live in more human-scaled communities than they can in most of America.
It seems like in this era, there was a lot of change happening to and in our cities. There's a lot of these supposed great works, with air quotes, happening in our cities. And this was beyond just building urban freeways. We have Bob Moses in New York building things like Lincoln Center and all the highways and all the urban renewal. All these were considered blight removal. In Boston, there's a ton of urban renewal. The BRA is happening and it's clearing huge sections of downtown Boston to build City Hall and the Federal Complex. And this is happening all throughout America. But there's also some anti-highway and anti-urban renewal agitation happening. Can you tell us how this was showing up in the DC region?
Urban renewal went through various phases after World War II. Originally, the plan was to build more housing. That became transmuted, for better or worse, into looking at commercial areas as well. And some of the original urban renewal plans in Washington and in other cities were pretty devastating. The idea was to take a massive amount of land and scrape it clean, bulldoze it flat, and build something entirely new. This happened in the southwest portion of Washington, where upwards of 20,000 people were displaced from their homes, majority African American, and not really provided with any opportunity to return to the buildings that were built in their place or given good options. And in Washington, as in other cities, urban renewal often went along with highway construction because engineers saw a twofer. They could not only knock down the buildings that they considered blighted or slums, but they could also get the massive amount of clear land needed to build a multi-lane freeway. This happened in Washington, as in other cities. The difference, to some degree, in Washington was a very early reaction against this. And so subsequent plans were scaled back. Where you have urban renewal in Washington after that, in many cases, it was smaller scale or designed even to rehabilitate existing structures rather than destroy them. And as part of that preservation of the traditional urban fabric, planners looked to rapid transit, which can deliver a lot of people, but with a lot less disruption to existing buildings.
These sorts of urban renewal programs were happening throughout America. In episode one of this podcast, we spoke with Joshua Junker. He talked about the elimination of the whole Cincinnati neighborhood, where 20 to 30,000 people were told they have to leave. Back then, Cincinnati was a strong mayor system, so it was Boston, New York. What's different about how Washington, D.C. was run and administered back when Metro was forming?
Article 1 of the Constitution gives special power to Congress over what was called a federal district, and this became Washington, D.C. It became the capital in 1800, and on and off over the decades and centuries, we've had multiple interpretations of what that meant. Prior to 1974, residents of the District of Columbia had very little power of self-government. Government was essentially appointed by Congress, a commissioner government. And while those commissioners would sometimes listen to what the residents want, they were by no means responsible to an electorate. This meant that the members of Congress still had a lot of power. Some of them used that power in rather tyrannical ways, particularly William Natcher of Kentucky used his power on the House Appropriations Committee to impose, or at least seek to impose, his will on the city. That included a program of highway building. Other members of Congress were more sympathetic to local concerns, and the White House mattered a great deal as well. So President Kennedy, in particular, tried to stay on the good side of his Georgetown neighbors and others. He had lived much of his life in Washington by the time he took on the presidency and was very committed to the city. And so even under that period of congressional rule, local residents did have some influence in the federal government and in the Kennedy administration, and to some extent in the Johnson administration in particular. Thanks to that influence, they were able to persuade both the president and Congress to look to alternatives to freeway building.
Your book, The Great Society Subway, which everyone should read, tries to make a direct link to some of these larger acts of civic building and the value of government and what government could do well and big. I'd like to know why this book and how did this book come about?
The book grew out of my own experience in growing up in Washington. I had grown up the first part of my childhood in New York City, where there seemed to be a subway on every corner, but also the subway was a somewhat wretched place in the 1970s, I'm sorry to say. And when we came down to DC in 1977, there was a little stub of a metro system that struck me as not very serious. For one thing, it didn't go many places. It was much too clean to be a functioning subway. As I grew, Metro also grew. It came closer and closer to my house, eventually reaching my neighborhood when I was 14 years old. So before I had a driver's license, I was able to travel around the city. And I also came to appreciate its design even more so as I traveled more. And again, I got to see cities without rail systems. I remember my shock, particularly in Phoenix, Arizona, just seeing this vast expanse of pavement. And so one of the questions I had coming into the project was, why were people still building rail in the 1960s when so many cities had rejected new subways and cut out their streetcar systems? But also the consequences of that. How did the existence of Metro shape Washington and its surroundings? So it's a story of decision-making. It's a story of politics. It's a story of land use. The term Great Society Subway is something I made up. It's not something I found in the documents. But it was my effort to draw a linkage between the rhetoric of the liberals of the 1960s and into the 1970s, particularly Kennedy, particularly Lyndon Johnson, to some extent even Richard Nixon, not that he was particularly interested, but he did have people in his administration, such as Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who were interested in cities, who were interested in architecture, who hoped to use the power of government to make the city a better place for Americans to live. And this is in contrast to more small government or libertarian approaches that are often sympathetic to the idea that if Americans want to drive, you should just let them drive and keep paving as much of America until people can drive anywhere they want.
My conception of Metro is that it's this unique system where at the edges and the periphery, the stations are spread out. So it might act a little bit more like commuter rail or regional rail. There's a lot of parking, both structured and lots. But then you start getting in the urban core, the spacing between the stops gets a little bit more like an urban metro. Can you talk about how that came to life as Metro evolved from this idea of not building all these urban highways and to give people a choice?
Metro is a hybrid between a commuter rail system and a traditional urban subway. You can see that in the design of the cars, which have three doors on each side. A commuter rail has fewer stops. You can get people off more quickly. Maybe you have two doors on a side. I believe that's the case in BART till today in the San Francisco Bay, whereas with a very busy urban system, you might want to have four doors on each side to get people off and on at these very busy stations. You see it in the amount of space in the car is devoted to seating or standing. If you're taking short trips, you want more room for standees. If you've got more of a commuter rail 40-minute trip, people really want to be able to sit down for that. So there's a hybridity or compromise on the car design. That's also true of the station spacing, where stations can be within a couple blocks of each other in the heart of downtown DC and miles apart as you get out into the more distant suburbs to keep up the speeds and allow that commute to stay within reasonable bounds. You can't have a 10-mile commute where people are stopping every quarter mile. It would just take forever to get where you're going. It's also true of the outlying stations where you have a lot of parking so people can drive to the station and continue the rest of the way on the train, whereas in the more urban sectors, not only in Washington, but again, some of the suburbs, Bethesda, Arlington, and now Tyson's Corner, you don't want parking there. You want people to get off the train and not have to walk across a sea of cars to get to their destination. Again, whether it's a store or an office or a library, you want those things clustered around the station.
Speaking of stations, I love for us to spend some time about them. As a New Yorker, I love our subway system, but it doesn't have any innate beauty. Metrorail and the stations are different. The stations and the whole experience seem fairly composed and engaged, which makes sense since it was all designed as a unit in sort of one go. How did the design of the experience in the stations come about?
The station design for Metro has a couple of origins. One is the more idealistic sense of confidence in federal government, confidence in the public realm that was expressed by the Kennedy administration in the famous Guiding Principles for Federal Architecture, drafted by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, that called on federal buildings, especially those in Washington, to provide visual testimony to the dignity, enterprise, vigor, and stability of the American government. So partly the idea was, if this is going to be a subway for the federal city, it should look great. The other more mundane but equally important impetus was the fear that if people built anything that resembled the New York City subway, no one would want to ride it. New York City subway in the 1960s was on a downhill slope. I don't think it hit bottom until the 1970s with the graffiti and some of the other problems. But it was perceived as being fairly cramped, fairly dirty, fairly dark, fairly confusing. And if that's your only choice, because it's difficult to drive in New York City and lots of people don't have cars, then that doesn't matter. People would ride it regardless. But for people in Washington who were already driving and had to be lured out of their automobiles, they needed something better than that. So the federal government, which at that point was planning rapid transit, it had not yet taken the name Metro, decided to hire an architect and really go big. And the way you do that is with a national competition and a jury and all of that. And they end up with Harry Weiss of Chicago, who had experience with supermarket design and dealership design and other kinds of prototypes where you build a prototype and then you adapt it to circumstances. He was very much a modernist, but not the boxy Bauhaus modernists. He came out of Cranbrook School and its Finnish and other Scandinavian influences, with more curves and more interest in different kinds of materials and attention to local context. He had not worked on transit systems before. He got a round-the-world ticket to see transit systems in Europe and Japan and North America, and I have yet to find anyone who's willing to pay me to do the same, but if you know a good agency, let me know. And came back with all kinds of sketches and ideas and put them together in a design for a prototype that would be based on a vaulted ceiling without the heavy columns that are so characteristic of more traditional systems like New York, or the low ceilings, the kind of cramped underground spaces that he feared would make people not want to ride. So he brings up this design. It has to go through various refinements, conversations with the engineers of what was possible and was practical, and also review by the United States Commission of Fine Arts, which has jurisdiction over federal architecture in the Washington area. And we can debate which elements came from which, but the end product was a visually spectacular design of these 600-foot-long arched vault stations with indirect lighting by Bill Lamb, with concrete mezzanines that don't touch the walls, in part to give a kind of floating sense and in part to discourage graffiti. Again, that mixture of the principled and the practical. We can debate whether the term brutalist is appropriate. It's not a term that I've seen in the historical record, but certainly at times we said things that seemed to come out of the brutalist ethos. I think we're telling the structural truth about the thing, not having veneers. We adopted, hopefully, the idea we don't have to hang any finishes there. He did not want to cover up the concrete with some kind of marble or paint or anything else. He wanted that concrete exposed. He wanted the stations to reveal their structural integrity. And again, this is consonant with other brutalist projects of the period.
Okay, I'm going to cut in here. So brutalism was an architectural style which emerged in the, say, the 1950s and persisted well into the 80s. It's not just a pejorative term for building traditionalists don't like, though it's come that way. Brutalist buildings are often composed of minimalist, where they reveal the base building and the structural materials that hold it up without any additional applied decoration or ornament. The phrase came about in a 1955 essay by architectural critic Rainer Burnham, who associated the movement with the French phrase béton brut, or raw concrete. Brutalism as a style and set of buildings has really taken a beating recently. Oftentimes, they are called ugly or stark, and oftentimes, they're just demolished and replaced with contemporary schlock. When I think of brutalism, I think of Paul Rudolph and Marcel Breuer. They were noted brutalists, and it was really Louis Kahn who I think fits into this idea of brutalism, of showcasing the raw materials and structure and quote-unquote honesty of a building. I think Louis Kahn really fits into that, but no one really wants to label him as brutalism. That's kind of reserved for Paul Rudolph and this exposed aggregate concrete. And I think the same goes with the Washington Metro. Stylistically, the stations conform to the definition of brutalism, but because people like it and they're beautiful, the label is generally not applied. So that's some editorializing. Okay, back to Professor Schreck.
He also was interested in earth tones. This was the 1970s, after all, that we were getting into. So you end up with the red terrazzo tile and later with rail cars that were designed by another firm, orange and brown seating. And one absolutely key material to the Metro design is the light. Harry Weese had worked with William Lamb, lighting designer, previously, including a church in Columbus, Indiana, marvelous museum of modern architecture. And Lamb had very important theories about lighting, not just as quantity, but as quality, to design lighting that would orient people in space. And for Metro, as in some other projects, he used a lot of indirect lighting where he was washing the vault with lights rather than shining the lights down. And he believed that this would make people more comfortable. It would feel more outdoors, like a sky rather than a vault or a tunnel or a mineshaft, and also orient them to where they were, make it easy to pass through the stations with the minimum of signage. And it would just feel very natural that you were moving on to the next place. This design was approved in the 1960s and later adapted to the various conditions. They certainly have common elements, but every station has a somewhat different geometry, and Weese was able to adapt the design to those specific station sites.
What's your favorite station?
The prototype station that Weese was thinking about a lot was Judiciary Square. And that remains a magnificent station. Certainly a great deal of detail and thought went into it to adapt the prototype to the specific spot. And it does have one of the great exits of the system where you take the escalator up and you are looking directly at Montgomery Meigs's pension building, now the National Building Museum, which we hope to replicate in other places, but often could not get the permission to have those really dramatic exits from the system. It also helps that the National Building Museum is a wonderful place. So it's just happy to go up that escalator and walk right into the museum and learn more about architecture and design. DuPont Circle is very impressive, but not as structurally honest. It is a mined station with precast concrete lining rather than the structural vault of Judiciary Square. So I think for a purist, Judiciary Square has to be the one to go.
When I think about the station is, so we've got the indirect lighting, we've got the coffered ceilings, we're floating down to oftentimes the platform is in the center. We've got this wonderful hexagonal quarry tile. We have the signage and the wayfinding that was designed. Oftentimes there's these like brownish monumental, they're not obelisks, but the
pylons.
Yeah, the pylons. Yes. Can you talk about that? Can you talk about that part? Because I think though all those pieces together in my mind's eye all create something that, for lack of a better term, is monumental. It feels like it has scale and gravitas.
You're talking about the different elements working mm-hmm. together? Certainly with a transit system, you're thinking about moving people through a space. And part of the hope was that you could always see where you were going next. Again, one of the things that can make people uncomfortable in an underground system, especially one that has grown up organically over time, such as the New York City subway with some of those transfers like Times Square, is you don't really know where you're going. You've got this long tunnel and you can't see the end of it. And the idea for Metro was not to have blind corners, not to have long tunnels, but to guide people through a friendly space and down from the street outdoors to a kind of underground street. If you look at the Metro system, one of the underground stations, you have benches, as you might have outdoors. You have an artificial sky, which is the vault as designed by Weiss and lit by Lamb. And you have even a curb, which is the granite edge of the platform that was originally designed to provide some color contrast to help people who were visually impaired avoid falling into the tracks. Other systems since then have had yellow striped tile put in to serve that, though bumps have been added to give more texture difference because the difference from the tile to the granite was not sufficient to keep people from straying onto the tracks if they were visually impaired. So there have been some adaptations, but that was one where Weiss's design was successful. And there's a certain amount of playfulness. This is something that Weiss was known for, is he liked to have fun. And sometimes that meant having things that did dual work. So with those granite edges, not only are they a visual contrast, but they also have lights embedded in them. And those lights start blinking when a train is approaching. So they're both giving you a warning. This is where the platform ends. Don't take another step because you'll fall into the tracks. But also, hey, they become a system for letting you know that a train is coming in. The pylons are the same. They serve as signage showing what station you're in with the graphics by Massimo Vignelli, famous Helvetica font that he helped popularize. But they also serve as lighting and they also serve as ventilation. So this was a way for Weiss to get multiple functions out of a single structure and to reduce the clutter. This becomes very important in Metro's history that one of the challenges of the Weiss design is it was minimalist. He did not want a lot of signage. He did not want a lot of clutter. He had seen that in London and didn't like it. And minimalist designs are quite vulnerable as the system ages and people say, we need another thing here, whether that thing is another sign or another light or another speaker. And it can very easily damage the aesthetic if those things are added haphazardly.
That insight about minimalism is well put. You can't channel future interventions if you create this minimalistic blank canvas, because then it's just going to go everywhere and it's going to probably go right where you didn't want it to go. Metrorail launched, it grew in both lines and ridership, and today Metro is dealing with how to maintain and operate the system. There's been some less positive introductions in how to keep the stations operational and state of good repair. Most famously, someone decided to paint some of the concrete vaults off-white in a misguided maintenance program, and people got really up in arms about that. How has Metrorail grown and adapted over the years?
The challenge of adapting Metro in light of experience began before the system opened. And I'm thinking specifically of challenges from people with disabilities who looked at the designs and said, where are the elevators? Because the original design for Metro did not have them. It had escalators, which for the 1960s was a step up, so to speak, from the New York City system with its long staircases. But originally, Weiss did not expect to include elevators. People who used wheelchairs demanded them. Of course, it's not only people who used wheelchairs, it's people with strollers, people with luggage, people with bicycles. There are a lot of good reasons to have elevators in the system. Weiss resisted, eventually caved in, thankfully, because those are very useful. But some of the older stations, such as Gallery Place, had to have the elevators added as an afterthought with resulting awkwardness in terms of flow and design and all the rest.
As the system has matured, what have been some of the growing pains that Metrorail has experienced since opening day?
Ever since then, there have been additional demands in the system. Again, many of them for very important reasons, whether it's disability access, whether it's because people didn't know what station they were in, whether it's because of emergency requirements, whether it's because of things breaking, that the people who operate the system have said, oh, let's put in another speaker, let's put in some more wiring, let's put in some more signs. And unfortunately, however intentioned without good design, these tend to degrade the system as much as they improve it. Fortunately, in the last decade or so, especially since 2015, the authority has been somewhat more aware of the need to be a good steward of its historic architecture. That has meant including people inside the authority whose job it is to think about historic preservation and documentation. It also means working with outside firms such as firm of KGP, which is Bill Gallagher, who was a protege of Weiss. And particularly impressive, I think, has been the lighting redesign by Claude Engel.
Yes, please talk about the lighting, because I think this is one of the more impressive use of indirect lighting in America.
The lighting had been a problem really since opening. For all of Lamb's ideas, they were fragile. If you had concrete that was too dark, it wouldn't reflect enough light. If you had light bulbs that degraded over time, you wouldn't have enough light. If you had dust from the brakes settling on the lights and they weren't clean because the lights were shining up, the dust would come down on them, and to the point where some of those stations were uncomfortably dark for people who wanted to read a newspaper or just not bump into things. I do think the introduction of smartphones was great for Metro in that they have their own light, but everyone could agree that they were not as bright as they should be. Fortunately, Metro got a call from Claude Engel, a lighting designer, who said, I think I can fix this. He went back to Bill Lamb's original designs and replaced the plans for fluorescent bulbs with LEDs that, of course, are much longer lasting and require less electricity. But he very carefully designed the LEDs to have the right temperature, to have the right pattern to mimic Lamb's original fluorescent designs. And the result is that as those station lights were replaced, Metro's lighting design looked as good as it ever had. And this is particularly evident in some of the downtown stations. Metro Center is just a wonder these days in terms of the lighting. So that was a big success.
I think another iconic part of Metro is the map designed by Lance Wyman and Bill Cannon of Wyman and Cannon. The diagram fits within the larger modernist design that sits alongside Massimo Vignelli's signage system. In a future episode, we're going to go deeper in the map and some of the interventions around digital wayfinding. But I'd love to hear about how some of the secondary objects evolved.
The map, which had been hailed widely when it was introduced in 1976 as a wonderful piece of op art, essentially, and got more and more cluttered as more stations were added, as politicians insisted on renaming stations with longer names, as people said, let's have more symbols for parking or Amtrak or commuter rail. And it had become something of a mess. Fortunately, as the Dulles Extension was being planned, WMATA, the transit authority, went back to the original designer, Lance Wyman, said, can you fix this? He redesigned the map, and for now, it is in much better shape than it was in the early 2000s. Another example that I've brought up, not really a historic preservation example, but an adaptation to circumstances, are the canopies over the outdoor escalators. These were talked about in the 1960s. Weiss and other people decided against them. Weiss had seen exposed escalators in other countries, including Scandinavia and Germany, places with fairly harsh environments, and they were working fine. In the 1980s, the American Society for Mechanical Engineers said, yeah, you really do. Whether that was based on evidence, I don't know. But at some point, the transit authority decided it needs to cover its outdoor escalators. The original plan was some very crude box. And fortunately, the architectural community in the Washington area spoke up, said, let's do this right. The transit authority had another jury competition, and it was won by some architects, local architects, John Lurie, Richard Chenoweth, and Richard Howden, who designed canopies that are an homage to Weiss's design, but also contain some new elements. And again, this is, I think, a good way forward, is you don't want to be stuck in the past, but you want to be respectful of the past. And so the good designs for Metro going forward, whether it's the map, whether it's the canopies, whether it's lighting, whether it's other station elements, is to find the right balance between being respectful of the original design, but not simply trying to replicate it. I'm Zachary Schrag. I'm a professor of history at George Mason University in Virginia. I'm the author of The Great Society Subway, a history of the Washington Metro, which was published in 2006. And I'm currently at work on a follow-up volume that will cover the Dulles Corridor extension from the original ideas in the 1960s through its completion in 2022.
That was a deep dive into the history of the Washington Metro. I want to thank Professor Schrag for his time, and everyone should go buy his book, get it from the library. It's called The Great Society Subway. It talks about the economic, the societal, and all the different contexts of building Metro Rail and how it connects to the larger aim of good governance. Now, in future episodes, we're going to talk a little bit more about both the map itself, the difference between diagrams and geographic projections. You got some of that last episode with Peter Lloyd, where every map is a visual poem. We're also going to talk about the new digital signage and wayfinding tools, and we're going to talk about how Metro has evolved. So as always, the views, opinions, comments on this podcast are mine only. They do not reflect any employer, past or present. You knew that. Everybody, keep going. Be local. Be the change you can believe in. A lot of people have been talking about looking for the helpers. I would like you to look in a mirror. You are the helper. Let's go help each other out. And we hope you're well. As always, go to jwp.news for more podcasts. Please heart, like, share these recordings. And we just really hope that everyone is doing well. And as we go into the end of the year, just find some peace and wellness for each other and look after each other. And with that, we'll see you on the internets, and good day.